Few people, so welcome. I think I said something earlier about how we just finished an introductory course, a 5-week course, and the next one I'll do is in May. But I usually try to give a little bit of instruction just to get, you know, like I did at the beginning of the sitting today, for those who might be new. And then the talks and discussion that happens after the sitting is on Thursdays is more oriented towards details of practice, of actually meditation practice, and it's more for beginners, but for anybody who wants to talk about meditation itself. Whereas usually Monday evenings, when we have our meetings Monday, it's more wide-ranging, the topics that are discussed. And also, we have a new newsletter for April, May, and June, which is our schedule of events. And I think it's available out there on the table. So if that interests any of you, you're welcome to take one. A traditional topic, and a very important topic for meditation practice, is what's called in Buddhism the five hindrances. And many people, when they teach many other teachers, when they do their introductory course, will talk about the hindrances as a part of the course. And I didn't do that, but I'll use the first evening after it to kind of make up for the loss. There is a quote from the Buddha where he says, "Luminous is this mind, brightly shining, but it is colored by the attachments that visit it. Luminous is this mind, brightly shining, but it is colored by the attachments that visit it." And this little sentence there is found in almost all Buddhist traditions, or one of the few sentences that all Buddhist traditions have in common. And it's kind of like the idea is that underneath all the attachments and preoccupations and things that there's a luminous quality of awareness, a luminous quality of presence or of mind, which is at the center, the core, or at the nature of our very being itself. And that's obscured for most of us by what this says is by the attachments that visit it. The attachments, preoccupations, fixations, fears, worries, anxieties, all these things are not in the nature of the luminous awareness itself, but rather visit it or cover it. They're sometimes called visitors. And Buddhism sometimes will use a lot of glorious words and adjectives to talk about awareness, luminous awareness, pristine awareness. They'll use many kind of adjectives because it's such a wonderful and precious thing that we all have. But sometimes in all the different strong adjectives that they might use, it sounds like a really grandiose and fantastic thing that has nothing to do with us in our life. But it's something very simple, just the simplicity of being aware, of being present, of simply noticing our breath coming and going in a very simple, gentle way, or noticing going out, you know, in the night sky and seeing the stars in the night sky, or seeing, it's beautiful right now, spring coming. You can see some of the little bushes, like where I live, they have these hazelnut bushes. And right now the hazelnut leaves are just beginning to poke out. And there's something really exquisite about these little brightly kind of vibrant hazelnut leaves that are just coming out of their branches. And just to be aware of that is a very simple act. But most of us spend much of our life preoccupied with the past or the future or fantasies or concerns or worries or anxieties or projects and deadlines and all these things. But it's very easy to miss the simplicity of seeing the beauty of a bud of hazelnut coming out, or the stars. And this simple thing called awareness is something that, which is celebrated and honored and cultivated and in many different ways in Buddhist practice. There's a story of the... many of you, I think I've told this, and many of you probably know the story, of when the Buddha was enlightened. All the forces of distraction, of temptation, of that keeps you from really being fully in the present moment and fully waking up to the present moment, visited him, because that's kind of the nature of the mind. And so things like his fears and his resentments, his angers, his griefs, his lusts, his and his, finally his doubts besieged him. And what it said is that the Buddha then vanquished or overcame those forces, and then proceeded to become fully awakened, fully present. And in one tradition of Buddhism, the Buddha's awakening, his enlightenment, was supposed to have happened in the early morning. He sat up through the whole night. In the early morning, he saw the morning star. And in seeing the morning star, he was awakened. And again, it's so simple to really see and really be present, to be aware. And we need to give ourselves half a chance to really do it over and over again. But these forces of temptations or distraction that visited the Buddha are personified by the Buddhist tradition as being Mara, kind of the Buddhist devil. And then it said he conquered Mara the night of his enlightenment. And I thought, well, that's it. He's, you know, it's Mara's fit, you know, it's not going to reappear. But what you find later in the sutras and the scriptures that describe the Buddha's life, Mara keeps reappearing in the Buddha's life. And the question is, well, if Mara's personification of inner psychic forces of distraction, what is it that, why do they keep visiting the Buddha if the Buddha has conquered them, overcome them? And what's interesting is not, what's most interesting about these stories is what the Buddha does when Mara visits. And each time Mara visits, the Buddha doesn't say, you know, get lost, or he doesn't put on, you know, bring out a big sword and start chopping away, or karate kicks, or he doesn't run away in shame or try to hide or anything. He doesn't even invite Mara for tea. All he does is say, Mara, I see you. That's all he does. At which point Mara always runs away. And there's this... you wish, huh? And there's something very powerful about seeing clearly what's actually happening. And often, you know, I think most of us know this, if you see clearly enough, the power that things have over our life often at least fade, maybe not go completely away. Now mindfulness is a practice of recognition, in a sense. It's using our awareness, the simplicity of awareness, to recognize actually what's happening moment by moment. It's to recognize what meets our awareness. So awareness happens and it receives and registers, you know, what's going on, our breath or sensations in our body or people sitting in a room or the lights on, you know. Awareness receives all that, and then mindfulness has the function of recognizing what that is, those patterns of color, those sensations. So mindfulness recognizes what awareness meets. And what happens is, as our mindfulness and awareness become more expansive, more inclusive, more free, what it'll naturally do is to come up against, to meet that part of our life that doesn't want necessarily be met with awareness, that has some resistance to awareness, that is closed to awareness, where there's fear or worry or resistance or many different forces. And so sometimes, you know, the progression of developing mindfulness sometimes progresses quite nicely and pleasantly. You get calmer and more accepting, more peaceful, more alert. But sometimes what we meet is things which are not necessarily so comfortable. And sometimes people then are discouraged because, oh, wait a minute, you know, suddenly I'm filled with anger, or I'm filled with fear, or I'm filled with lust, or I'm filled with whatever. And they, well, that's, you know, I blew it. You know, I was on a good track for a while with my mindfulness, and then suddenly this came out of left field, and I might as well, you know, get up and make a sandwich. But what you should know is that as mindfulness does become more settled and more trusting to open up to more of our life, we often meet we meet the outer edges or limits of our awareness. It's kind of like awareness kind of grows in concentric circles, perhaps, as a metaphor. And it goes fine for a while, and then at some point it meets where there's resistance. And then you have to learn how to work with the resistance. And then you go beyond it, and you expand nicely for a while, and you meet another resistance. And that's a little bit sometimes what happens in mindfulness practice. So rather than being discouraged when you find some difficulty in your sitting, you should just take it as a welcome visitor and say, you know, this is what I'm going to practice with. See where my attachments, where the holding is in this particular situation, and see, can I find a wider trust that allows my awareness to be cultivated and grow wider in this particular problem, this particular limitation. And I say this, I think, maybe too often, but I think the best attitude to have, as, you know, one attitude to have is no attitude at all, which is the Buddha's attitude, which is simply, Mara, I see you. I see this anger, I see this frustration, I see this fear, I see this whatever. But I think a nice attitude to have is that of a naturalist. A naturalist goes into the woods and just observes without interfering or making judgments, supposedly. It's a good naturalist. Just, it's nature doing its thing, and the naturalist is there observing very carefully with great respect. And to be a naturalist of our inner life is what we do in mindfulness. We're just there for it, we allow it to be there, and we simply see it with respect and care, not judging our anger, not judging our frustration, not judging our shame, not judging anything. Just, oh, this is interesting. Can I be present? Can I explore it like a naturalist to get to know it better? Not pushing away, holding on to it. Now there are five, so the Buddhist traditions, there's many things that pull our attention away from the present moment, that makes awareness, being present awareness, difficult. And I think anybody who does a little bit of mindfulness practice becomes familiar with some of this. I mean, I'd be surprised if any of you, even those of you who might be new today, haven't noticed that your mind wasn't totally pristinely present for 30 minutes to the present moment, but probably your mind drifted off, just maybe once or twice. But are these things that pull us away? And it could just simply be mild distraction, kind of surface chatter of the mind. But there can also be more powerful forces. And learning to recognize these more powerful forces that distract us from being present is a very important part of meditation practice. And that's what the teaching of the five hindrances is about. And these, the five hindrances are, maybe say it again, they're those things, those inner tendencies, forces, preoccupations, which tend most strongly to make it difficult for us to be present, to be aware. So the first one is sensual desire, desire for sensual pleasure. The second is aversion or anger or ill will. The third is sloth and torpor. And the fourth is restlessness and anxiety. And the fifth is doubt. I used to not like to use the word hindrance because there's an attitude sometimes in Buddhism that there are parts of ourselves, our inner, you know, inner life, that are, you know, bad and you have to get rid of. And sometimes you get the language in Buddhism of the warrior who brings a sword of wisdom and slashes off the heads of the hindrances to get rid of them. And I don't think that kind of language is very useful for us, especially in the West. But I think it's not very useful. It's also not very accurate for the attitude of mindfulness. Nothing is taken as being the enemy in mindfulness. Nothing is taken as being a problem. The problem with hindrances is not the particulars themselves, each of these mental forces, but rather it's their hindering quality. It's the fact they hinder awareness. I call them black holes of awareness. These black holes are these stars that have such strong gravitational forces that any light that travels by or goes into them doesn't leave. It gets trapped there. So the black hole, the hindrances are kind of like black holes of the mind. We tend to get so enchanted or so caught up or preoccupied or fixated on these five things that the light of awareness gets lost in them, and it's very difficult to be present and aware when these things are present. So it's the hindering quality that's the problem, not sensual desire itself, not anger or aversion itself. And in order to overcome the hindering quality, is we need to kind of bring a counterforce to that gravitational force of those things, the enchantment of those things. And that force is the strength of our mindfulness, the strength of clearly seeing this is what's going on. I also like to talk about sometimes synonyms for mindfulness, because in different situations in daily life, different synonyms seem to apply better rather than just mindfulness. And one nice synonym is participation. So rather than asking, how can I participate more in the situation? How can I be more mindful in the situation? How can I participate more? But another one is intimacy. How can we be more intimate in this situation? The hindrances are those things which hinder intimacy. Too much sensual desire will hinder intimacy. I think anybody who's been a teenage boy knows a little bit about that. And I don't know about teenage girls, but certainly boys, I can speak for them. That certain kind of intimacy is lost when there's too much lust and sensual desire going on. Also, the hindrances tend to fragment us because they tend to pull us off into many different directions rather than letting us rest kind of in the core of our being, in the centeredness of ourselves. And the tendency, because we get lost in the hindrances, the fragmentary quality of our life tends to get stronger and stronger if we just give way to them over and over and over again. And many of us find ourselves very fragmented because of all the different pulls we have. And it can be really exhausting. So, many ways that we get fragmented. One is a sensual desire tends to scatter the mind at times. And ill will tends to create divisions. It cramps the mind, divisions within us, divisions within us and the rest of the world. Sloth and torpor is connected to unprocessed content of the consciousness, the unprocessed content of our mental and emotional life. Agitation and anxiety or worry tends to tire the mind with restlessness and just kind of just all over the place at once. And doubt represents a kind of unwillingness or vacillation of the mind, an unwillingness to participate, an unwillingness to be present, or a vacillation, a kind of vacillation, kind of undecisiveness of mind. So sensual desire is the first one, and learning to recognize that in our meditation is very important. And it takes many, many different forms. One is the desire to be more comfortable. And it's nice, I'd say, every time we start sitting, say, make yourself comfortable. But and you should, you do the reasonable things to be comfortable. But comfort is not something that's always going to be happening in your meditation, or in your life even. And if you, some people are addicts to comfort. That there's something fundamentally wrong they feel with being uncomfortable, and they have to escape it at all costs. It's possible to be at ease with discomfort. And if you're always running away from discomfort, you don't discover that deeper kind of ease that is possible in those situations. So in meditation also, if you're kind of always chasing after comfort in your sitting, you'll always be moving and being restless. And if you're always moving in your meditation, you're always kind of agitating the mind and making it more difficult to settle. And then there's all kinds of wonderful fantasies of sensual desires that arise as we meditate. You start thinking about, you know, food, and wonderful foods, or you start thinking about vacations and wonderful places on the beach, or you start thinking about wonderful sexual partners and things you can do and wonderful, you know, fantasies. And it goes on, the kind of sensual desires that might arise in the mind as you're sitting here. And part of the reason why these are black holes is that sensual desires tend to be so enchanting. They tend to be kind of pleasant even, to be kind of lost in sensual desires and fantasies. And so you say, what's wrong with a little bit of pleasure? You know, I kind of, you know, I deserve it. It's about time I got some. So let me kind of wander away in this one for a while. And, you know, you're welcome to think that, you know, but the tendency to do that in meditation is a tendency to help, again, scatter the mind, scatter your ability to really be present in yourself. So if you need to kind of indulge in that kind of fantasy, you know, choose some other time to do it, not your meditation time. I'm fond of the fact that in English we have this word wanting. You say something is, so-and-so is, something is wanting. And it has a meaning, has, one of the meanings is that there's a lack, that something has a lack. There's something missing from something, so it wants it. There's a wanting of it. And I can't think of a good, what you might say is that this, the soup is wanting enough salt. I don't know, maybe that's a, you know. And I like that because often a strong, very strong sensual desire being pulled into a fantasy world arises sometimes out of a sense of lack, a sense of voidness or emptiness. And sometimes in exploring and being present for a strong desire in our sitting, in our practice, you can sometimes find that void or that lack or that boredom or whatever it might be. And enter that directly with your mindfulness. Be very conscious of it, rather than escaping from it. And if you do that, some marvelous thing will open up for you, a deeper intimacy with yourself. But the most important thing to do with each of these hindrances is simply to recognize it's happening. And in mindfulness, we become connoisseurs of these things. You say, ah, there it is. And we give these talks, you know, if you're going to spend a number of, I don't know, lifetimes or years or whatever, doing mindfulness practice and going on retreats, you'll, within a few years, you'll be able to give your own hindrance talk. And it's the most common talk given. At every retreat, there's an obligatory hindrance talk. And because it's so important to get to know these really well and recognize them when they first arise. And if we talk about them enough, maybe you'll recognize them, and so you see them, you know, when they first arise, rather than after you're lost in them for 10 minutes. So the first thing is to recognize these things. And then to feel what it's like in the body. Because often with it is a desire, there's different sensations in the body associated with that kind of desire. There's sometimes a leaning forward or reaching forward or uplifting of energy or a kind of, you know, kind of restlessness or a grasping. To feel that in the body, feel the loss of composure in your body when the desires are really strong. And just simply feel what that's like, explore it, get to know it. Or maybe recompose yourself in the present moment. Then there's I should say that what a lot of people don't know who don't have a spiritual practice is that the deepest joys, in a sense, deepest pleasures of life, are not feelings, are not kind of mental or physical feelings we can have. And because we don't know that, we tend to chase after mental and physical pleasures to fill ourselves with all kinds of great pleasures. In the spiritual world, there's a kind of deep, satisfying contentment or pleasure or joy, or even bliss at times, that has almost nothing to do with any feeling at all. And has nothing to do with anything that external world or the world of thoughts will provide you. Sometimes when people get lost in fantasy, it doesn't have to be a necessarily sensual fantasy. It can be, you know, once on retreat I spent, it was, you know, several days obsessing about some idea I had about some invention. I designed a new kind of helicopter. I don't know, you know, anything about engineering or helicopters or, and, you know, just, you know, I'm the last person to do things. But, you know, I had, you know, and I was thinking about the design, how to build it, and where to build a factory, and how I was going to sell it, and, you know, and it was like, and I was obsessed. And part of it was, it was very pleasant to thinking all this out. There's a great pleasure in this kind of thought. It wasn't necessarily, making helicopters wasn't a sensual desire, but the task of thinking about it was very pleasant for the mind. And I was hooked onto that pleasure. I was hooked onto that sensual desire of that kind of thinking. And until I could see that sensual desire, that sensual pleasure had on me, I was kind of stuck with the obsession. And if you're on a meditation retreat, you know, you don't want to spend 2 or 3 days thinking about helicopters. Partly because sensual desire, is so smooth and it kind of represents a state of enchantment, it's often very difficult to work with because we tend to get lost in it so easily. Aversion or ill will tends to be painful when that hindrance arises. And so we tend to notice it earlier, and we tend not to like ill will or that aversion, those feelings. And so we're sometimes much more eager to practice with it in order to get rid of it. But with mindfulness, we're not trying to get rid of anything, we're just trying to overcome its hindering quality, to really wake up and be present, say, ah, this is ill will, this is anger, this is aversion. See it very clearly, feel it in the body, and it's possible to find some kind of peace and acceptance even with these difficult states when they arise. But if you do it, but if you have enough acceptance and mindfulness, then like the story of Mara going away, these things will also go away. So ill will and aversion creates divisions in society, and it tends to isolate us. from others. It tends to separate ourselves from other people. And it's very much related to our tendency to like and dislike. And it's phenomenal. When I started learning, paying attention to my mind, and the degree to which I liked and disliked things and people, I mean, it seemed like it was incessant. All the time I was judging and doing this and that. And one of the things we learn in mindfulness practice by sitting still with what's happening, whether we like it or not, is we learn a kind of presence that's outside of our preferences, a kind of presence that's outside of whether we like or dislike something. And if our tendency is to be so governed by what our likes and dislikes, we'll kind of become slaves to it then. And to find an other presence, a presence that's not dependent on whether we like or dislike something, but willing to be present and open with the situation, regardless of what it is, that's a real, it's a gift to the world, it's a gift to yourself, and it's a very powerful tool to help you see clearly what's actually happening. So anger, ill will, has many forms. There's fury and rage, wrath, ire, resentment. Resentment is held anger. And there's no need to, again, I'm repeating myself, no need to hate aversion or ill will or anger. All you need to do is to see it clearly. And again, you can feel it in your body. And sometimes you feel it as burning or as tightness or tension or constriction of the mind or constriction of awareness. And it takes many forms. You know, it could be rather than desiring comfort in your meditation, you hate being uncomfortable. And you just have this tremendous aversion and you just kind of sending, you know, all your bad vibes towards your painful knee. Or like this friend of mine, he had a lot of knee pain when he meditated. I think he was sitting in full lotus. He was a Zen student. And whenever his knee hurt him, he would hurt it back by poking down like this. And he damaged his knee, he had to have knee surgery. It was kind of really, I mean, it's like, that's kind of extreme, right? But you know, we really dislike something, and so we spend our meditation kind of, you know, angry with the meditation, angry with the teachers, not ringing the bell, angry with, you know, whatever. Because we're caught in the world of aversion, ill will. Or someone comes into the meditation hall and they sit in front of you, and it's sitting such a way that maybe they're kind of blocking your view. And so your next 40 minutes of meditation, you're burning with, you know, ill will for that person. And it's not just simply that they're angry with the person for sitting there, but then you don't like their clothes they're wearing, and their socks are pointing back because they're sitting on their knees, and you don't like their still kind of socks. How could they, you know, and then, you know, this and that about them. And it's called the, you know, Vipassana Vendetta. And the mind can get pulled up in this. And part of some of the reason is that you find in America, I don't know if it's particular to America, but you find in America a kind of a justification for being angry. There's a kind of, you're supposed to be angry, it's okay to be angry, or you're just, or you're, it's, you know, anyway. And so we get into it. And what happens is we lose ourselves. And we do things which are not skillful. Well, I was going to say this earlier. The idea of sitting in silence and not doing anything for half an hour or 45 minutes or an hour or however long you meditate is very foreign, I think, to many people in our culture. People, if you're really silent and don't speak for half an hour, maybe you're too complacent or too passive, is sometimes the attitude. You're not being efficient and being active and out there and doing stuff. And so I know that some people who meditate or struggle with this kind of these voices within them. And one of those voices is, if you're just sitting silent and not doing anything, being still, you're being passive. It's not worthwhile. You're not doing anything worthwhile. It's actually tremendously worthwhile, because one of the reasons is that the sitting still and sitting silent allows for deeper movements within us to become clear. And that deeper movements, the clarification of deeper movements and intentions within us, deeper voices, allows us then to be more better citizens, better friends to our friends, better friends to ourselves. The third hindrance is sloth and torpor. Sylvia Borstein gave an interview on NPR. It's Michael Krasny, I think, interviewed her in November. And she described the hindrances this way. It was end of the interview, and he said, what are the hindrances? He said, but you only have a minute left. Can you describe it in a minute? And she said, yes, of course. And she said, that was brilliant. She said, this is her description. If we don't like something that's happening, there's five different ways that we can cope. One is we can lose ourselves in sensual fantasies, so we don't have to confront it. The other is we can lose ourselves and get preoccupied with aversion towards it. Just lash out at it and attack it and criticize it or whatever. The third way is we can shut down against it. Kind of become numb out. Become kind of sleepy and start yawning. And I had a Zen teacher who said, if you're reading a book, a spiritual book, and you come to a point where you start falling asleep in the book, that's the place you should pay attention. So you can numb out, or you can get really restless if you don't like it, and you can get lost in your restlessness or your anxiety or your worry, or you can be filled with doubt. What should I do? Should I go forward, go back, you know, whatever. So those are the five ways we can kind of get caught, lose ourselves, or avoid really confronting what seems to be difficult. Anyway, sloth and torpor, sometimes just plain old tiredness, but kind of a numbness sets in, a kind of dullness of the mind and the body that can sit in sometimes in meditation, arises, as I said earlier, of unprocessed psychic stuff that we don't necessarily, are uncomfortable, we don't necessarily want to confront and see. And the mechanism of avoidance is to fall asleep or get really tired. And when I work with people one-on-one sometimes, it's really, you can really see that when you get close to some really important issue, suddenly you see this big yawn and they say, you know, start getting sleepy. It's really, it's phenomenal that our biology has this mechanism. Sometimes sloth and torpor arises from wrong effort. You're trying too much, you're making too much effort in your practice, or you're not making enough and you're complacent. And if you don't make enough, if you don't have a balanced enough effort, you can get tired or get sleepy. So you check your effort, you check whether there's stuff there which you're uncomfortable to experience, and so are you avoiding something? And one of the things you can do is simply notice it. Clearly, I'm full of sloth, I'm tired, I'm dull, I'm numb. And again, you don't have to criticize it, you don't have to blame yourself or feel like something is wrong. All you have to do is recognize, this is what's happening. My mind is really dull, really dull. I'm having dull meditation. Dull meditation is successful meditation as long as you know you have dull meditation. But it can help to kind of attend to posture, sit up straighter, you get a little more energy. Sometimes you can open your eyes and it can make you more alert. The fourth hindrance is restlessness and anxiety. Sometimes the anxiety part is sometimes translated as remorse. The restlessness is physical excitement. Your body is just all restless and anxious and kind of energetic. Anxiety is excessive, is mental, it's excessive associated thinking that is probably irrational, but maybe not. But sometimes it has to do with remorse. You're kind of lost, you're preoccupied with your thoughts, you're anxious about something, you're worried about what's happening tomorrow, or you feel really guilty or bad about what you did in the past, and you're reviewing it and you're kind of wound up around it. And it's not so bad to be anxious, in a sense, because when anxiety is there, you know you're meeting something which you need to look at carefully. I'm kind of jumping around, but one of the images they give in the Buddhist tradition of the hindrances is that when you do mindfulness practice is like washing dirty clothes in water. And as you're washing dirty clothes, the dirt comes out into the water and the water gets dirty. And you don't criticize the water for being dirty when you wash the clothes, do you? It's, you know, you're glad that dirt's out there in the water, right? So mindfulness is like the soap of the mind or the heart. And as you do that, the soap releases the stuff. And where, guess where it gets released to? You know, into your awareness. And so you become aware of it. And you get to explore it and get to know it. So don't take it as being a problem when you feel the hindrances arise. And restlessness and anxiety are great things to experience in the body. To really feel it in the body clearly and commit yourself to sitting still with them is very, very powerful. Jack Kornfield likes to teach that why don't you be the first person to die of restlessness in meditation. You know, no one's ever died of restlessness. You know, you can manage. Just sit there. And it's very powerful. And sometimes we think that, you know, your mind has to be, you know, very crisp and alert or quiet or calm or blissed out in order to have successful meditation. Sometimes a successful meditation period is the fact that you're able to sit out the period to the end. It's sometimes like riding a bronco meditation, because, you know, just thoughts and concerns and worries and agitation and energy and all this stuff is happening like a tornado. And the fact that you were able to sit on your cushion and not get up, was fantastic. That was a completely successful sitting. So restlessness. And the fifth then is doubt. And it said that doubt is the most dangerous of the hindrances, because doubt is the one that we tend to believe. It tends to motivate us to action. We can doubt ourselves. You know, I can't do this. This is too much restlessness, I can't do it, or there's too much anger, or there's too much, I'm too whatever. You know, you have doubt, and maybe, you know, is this the best thing to do with my day, or am I supposed to be cleaning out the refrigerator? You know, what should I be doing? And was this the right meditation practice for me? Should I be doing loving kindness practice? Should I go do prostrations? Should I go do Sufi dancing? Should I go do, you can start going through the repertoire, and, you know, doubt, what should I do? And there's a lot of different doubts that can arise. A kind of indecision, a lack of trust. Doubt is kind of a holding back. It's an unwillingness to really come forward and be present in what's happening now, to kind of give ourselves to being present. Sometimes doubt arises because of the tremendous sense of inadequacy and unworthiness many people in the West feel. And so it would be very easy to doubt ourselves. And it's the most dangerous because it can be so strong that we can just give up and stop practicing entirely. And I would suggest that if you don't trust mindfulness practice, you either have misunderstood what mindfulness practice is, or you don't trust being present. Mindfulness practice is simply being present for our life as it is. So when you say, I don't trust, or I have doubts about this practice, it means you don't trust, or you have doubts about the value of being present to things as they are. That's as simple it is as it is. And doubt can be very strong. One of the things that can paralyze us and exhaust us, it's said that doubt is dissolved by faith. And faith means many things. It can mean trust in ourselves, it can be trust in the practice, trust in Buddhism, or in faith in the Dharma. And cultivating actively trust and faith is a very powerful antidote to doubt. Learning to discover trust within ourselves, learning to find our own good qualities, recognizing our good qualities. It's considered in Buddhism a great virtue to rejoice in your own good qualities and good deeds. Many people in the West say, well, gee, I can't do that, you know, that seems kind of arrogant. But actually in Buddhism, it's a virtue. So it's a great religion because it says it's a virtue to rejoice in your good qualities and good deeds, but there's no self. Isn't that great? It's kind of like the best of all worlds. So those things are sometimes antidotes to doubt. Antidotes. And then the last thing, which is kind of cute perhaps, but I mean it somewhat seriously, that if you find yourself with a huge doubt attack in meditation, I mean, this is not a minor thing. If you do these meditations for a while, you'll get attacked by these things in a major way. It's really. And then there's a multiple hindrance attack. You know, in all five of them, you know, all at once. And, you know, so learn to recognize them one at a time so that you're there for the full attack. But if you're full, all-out attack on doubt, what you can do is, rather than kind of trying to get rid of the doubt or work with it, doubt more thoroughly. So that means doubt your doubt. And there's a wonderful way in which we doubt, sometimes doubt everything, but we take the doubt for granted. If you can go to the trouble of doubting, doubt your doubt too, so you can be a little bit more at ease with it all. So those are the five hindrances. And I hope that in a couple of years you can all give wonderful talks of your on your own, because you'll understand them so well. And understand the joy of getting to recognizing them, so you can appreciate the simplicity of just being aware, and what a delight it is to be simply aware and awake in the present moment. Maybe if there's one question or comment, and then we'll sit again. Anybody want to say something? Yes.
For me, the big hindrance tonight is sloth and torpor. It's been such a struggle actually over a period of time when it comes to the day and night. And, you know, I try a number of little techniques, keeping the eyes open, focusing on my breath, trying to get very simple. And the sleepiness is sort of like this gray blanket that just arises again, and before I know it, I'm gone. It's discouraging.
Yeah. So could it be that you're tired?
Of course,
I'm tired. Yeah. I mean, you work the end of the day.
The end of the day, and generally when I do that, it's in the morning, it's the first thing I do, and I can stay with it.
Yeah. So if it's sleepiness, you don't have to fight it. All you have to do is try to be as aware as you can, be mindful as you can, and take it as a blessing that you got a little nap. You know, if that's what's happened, if you kind of fall asleep, just take it as a good sign you're relaxed enough to fall asleep.
Wouldn't that contradict part of what you were just describing in terms of it being a hindrance and the example of resistance?
Well, it might not be resistance. It might be, if you're tired, it's not resistance. You're just plain old tired. And your job is to be as mindful as you can, and whenever you can. But if you fall asleep, don't worry about it. When you wake up, then start again. What's important in mindfulness practice is the continuity of effort, not the continuity of clarity. So whenever you remember to make the effort to be present, bring that effort to there. And so it doesn't really matter if during certain periods of meditation you're sleepy, you're tired. If you bring the best effort you can at that particular time. And the best effort when you're sleepy is not as good as your best effort when you're, you know, early in the, awake in the morning. So what's the best effort you have right now? And the continuity of that is what really builds the practice over time. And I tell you that from having learned that through a lot of grief. Because when I was in Asia and did a lot of long retreats, I would get up like at 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. And you're supposed to stay up until like 10 o'clock at night or 11 o'clock at night. So you didn't get much sleep. And I would start getting sleepy around 3 or 4 or 5 in the afternoon. And I thought there was something wrong with me. You know, and I hated it, and I struggled, and I fought against myself, and I thought that I was failing in my meditation. And what I learned was, after a while, I learned, it's normal to be tired. You've been up since 2 or 3 in the morning. You know, it's just like, well, yeah, it's just, that's what's happening. But what I learned was that, more importantly, is that if I just kept making the best effort as I could, even though I knew it was not very good, that counted. So just that. And maybe you'll become the world expert connoisseur of what sleepiness feels like in the body. you know exactly, you'll be able to describe in great detail what it feels like around the eyes and the cheeks and the shoulders and so all that. But there's, you know, other practical things is you might, if you have time, if you have time when you get here, is to go outside and do walking meditation for 10 minutes. And it could be quite vigorous. Or come in late, you know, and go walk outside and just do walking meditation. And a strong bout of walking meditation can bring energy, good energy, and wake you up. And or it could be you need to sit longer. When I used to work and then meditate at the end of the day, I worked as a fast order cook, and it was very exhausting. I'd come back kind of, you know, frazzled and kind of scattered and everything, and tired. And for me, the first 20 minutes of my sitting, when I came home, was always really sleepy. And then I would somehow, everything would kind of settle and calm out, and then after 20 minutes, it would settle out, then I'd wake up. I don't know. If you think that it's probably just tiredness, but this is just a general statement to everyone. If you think that it has to do with avoiding something, one of the questions you can ask to help your mindfulness practice is ask, you know, what wants to be expressed here? Is there something that wants to be expressed? And sometimes that very, just raising that question can sometimes help kind of clear up what's really going on. You can let it poke its head up a little bit more and you can recognize it. And we can talk some more about it. So let's sit. Seems that you all have been talking about the precepts last month. At least some of you, those of you who have been coming. And I thought I would just say a few things about them and then hear from you. And then we'll have kind of a discussion until about 8:15, and then we could end the evening with 15 minutes more of sitting. Is there anything that... Before I start, is there anything that's pressing or that needs to be brought up that you want to ask at this point or give you a chance? Anything?
I would just like to say that even though our speakers who spoke in your place were really very marvelous, but there is that the empty part of me that's only maybe fleeting missed you. The other part that clings stubbornly to an independent self. I have no, you know, I'm not sure. But I just wanted to welcome you.
Thank you. What I thought of doing was just maybe talk a little more generally about precepts. In particular, since this is really a beginning class in meditation, beginning kind of supposed to be at least. See all these old timers here. I thought of just saying a few things about about the connection between meditation practice, mindfulness practice, and the precepts. I'll say some things kind of as an introduction, but what I would like to ask you when I finish my introduction is to ask you all what you think, very personally, aside from what you maybe hear from me, but what you feel is the connection between your own meditation practice, your own mindfulness practice, and ethical life, living a virtuous life. In Buddhism, we talk about the five precepts, not to kill and not to steal and not to lie, not to misuse sexuality, and not to misuse intoxicants. And there is a tradition in Buddhism that the precepts are a very joyful thing in people's lives. And that there are Buddhists who love the precepts. They take delight in not only the idea of the precepts, but delight in their own embodiment of the precepts and of ethical virtue, virtuous conduct. And so for me, this was kind of a surprise when I first was studying Buddhism, because for me, growing up in the West at the time that I did, there was a kind of a aversion to precepts, to anything that talks about precepts, anything that looked like shoulds, anything that you should be doing with your life. It felt like an external imposition and something that limited your life rather than kind of expressed the freedom of your life. And sometimes there was an abhorrence among my friends for such things as precepts. So they come across these Buddhists who really delighted in it, and they would rejoice in precepts and were very happy in their own, as I said, embodiment of the precepts. It was a surprise for me. And I think there is a joyful connection between mindfulness practice and the precepts. Someone pointed out to me recently, for a long time I'd heard about, you know, you shouldn't should your life, which is kind of, you can't really say it even. There's a difference between shoulds and coulds. And there's the things we could do, and there's the things we should do. And sometimes we confuse the two. But what things we could do are things that are within our potential, our possibility, that maybe we want to do. Maybe it kind of expresses some deeper potential for who we are, and it can be healthy and whole and healthy and wholesome to try to align yourself or to grow into that possibility. And I think the precepts are one of those. They're not shoulds, but they're certainly coulds. And part of the rejoicing, part of the joy that some people feel about them, the precepts, is that when you live a life according to the precepts, an ethical life, it allows you to walk through life without having to be ashamed, without feeling any shame. You can be kind of independent and open and receptive and vulnerable to the world and not have to worry about someone thinking bad about you or attacking you or feeling your own shame. Or you don't have to turn your eyes away from anybody. You can be equal to anybody that you meet. You don't have to kind of look down or kind of crawl around the sides, avoid people, or and all the kind of ways in which we might do that. You can actually meet someone directly, and you have nothing to hide, and you have nothing. You can just be there, and you don't have to do anything. You don't have to be brilliant or anything. But just you are complete, and you have nothing. You haven't made yourself incomplete by breaking precepts, and that's a wonderful thing. People to go through life with this kind of openness, that of a clear conscience. I talked this week with a woman who's been practicing mindfulness practice for about a year now, fairly intensively for the last 6 months, intensely every day for about 45 minutes every day, very, very regularly. And she's taken real delight in the practice, in the mindfulness practice. And she says in the last month or two, she's found that she's becoming really open-hearted. And she's never been so open-hearted before. And all these people, like her friends that she usually knows, the relationships are working so much nicer. And strangers she meets, and somehow it resonates. You know, her open-heartedness kind of is contagious, I guess. People get so, it's very, her life's been very nice. She doesn't know hardly anything about Buddhism and just came to one retreat. And then I kind of knew almost what she was going to say next. She had all this open-heartedness and feelings of intimacy with one of her old friends who wasn't her husband. And the passion, the sexual passion, rose dramatically. And she and her husband were out of town for that week. So what, you know, what to do? You know, and she was kind of, you know, she was kind of beside herself. What to do with all this energy and all this, you know, open-heartedness? And luckily, she didn't do anything except try to cope the best she could. And then she called me, and I explained to her. Well, I said, this is a very important lesson that Buddhist practice, the mindfulness practice, in a Buddhist context, is always held in the container of the precepts. And one of the ways that makes the practice safe to open up to all the stuff that can arise in the course of the practice, is you're gently being held within this wonderful container, this bowl of the precepts. And so you can, it's safe to let things come up, energies and feelings and fantasies and all, but you can explore them and deepen your connection with yourself by holding it within the precepts, so it means not acting on them. So she can feel that open-heartedness and explore it and get to know it. If she'd act on it, it would have been a disaster in her situation. She was completely happy with her husband. It wasn't like, you know, she was looking for someone else. And often what happens in a spiritual life is there is a kind of open-heartedness that happens. And it's very easy, that open-heartedness, to fall in love with people. And I don't know if it's just our culture, maybe it's universal, but there's a close connection between open-heartedness, feelings of intimacy, and sexuality. And a lot of people confuse the two. So expressions of intimacy, kind of open-heartedness, can be confused as being sexual interest or sexual kind of thing going on. And then you follow the wrong route, just the wrong fork. You take a kind of a detour for a while, rather than following the increasing opening of the heart, increasing deepening into our own integrity and deeper sincerity. So I think it's important to say that you know, that the precepts are a very important container for the practice. Well, I was going to tell you, maybe I won't say what I think the joy of, or the connection between meditation, mindfulness practice, and precepts is, any more than what I've said. It would be interesting to hear from you, what you guys think. Is what do you think the connection is between them? In a personal way, if you've ever reflected on it. And some of you have been talking about it for the last month, so you might have some thoughts. Yeah.
You have to be mindful to even be aware of the precept.
You have to be blindfold?
Mindful. like a precept I work with my some of my colleagues at work, constantly work with. This isn't part of the five precepts, it's part of the 10 Mahayana precepts of not talking about other people and elevating yourself.
Uh-huh.
And you'd be carrying on a conversation, one of us will say what we're doing, you know, and then we'll catch ourselves. But you really have to be mindful to, because it's so ingrained in our behavior, so part of the paramount of mindfulness,
yeah.
Where you're doing that.
Well, there's a couple of things about that. One is, it's really great to have a group of people who are doing it together with you, because they can help you catch it. And it becomes kind of a kind of a fun thing, you know. Rather than, you know, moralistic, say, "You look what you did." It's like they wink at you and you say, "Oh yeah, oh yeah."
Yeah, but the next day, but we're having so much fun doing it.
And the other thing about mindfulness, you need to be mindful. Sure, you need to be mindful, but taking on the precepts is a voluntary thing to take on. Is also then an aid to become mindful. And one of the monastic delights, if any of you ever want to try Buddhist monasticism for a while, it's a temporary thing. You can do it just for, you know, a few months. You don't have to do a lifetime commitment. So you can try it out for size. It's kind of fun. But one of the delights of being a monk or a nun is, which surprised me also, I thought, you know, when I became a monk, was what surprised me was that as a monk, you have to follow 227 precepts, not just 10 or 5. But in order to follow them, you have to be really mindful. And so it really sharpened my mindfulness. But not simply in being mindful. Well, I don't want to give away too much. But anyway, so taking on the precepts helps you become mindful. And becoming mindful can help you live a more ethical life. Uh-huh.
And I really have struggled with mindfulness, like I become more mindful about judgment oriented myself. And then the precepts I really have trouble with, because like at my worst I start to feel like the Antichrist or something.
Uh-huh.
And not quite sure what to, it may feel uncomfortable even.
Oh, the more mindful you are, the more your mindfulness mature, the more you realize you're breaking them all the time. But you don't. You, but
I was like, now I feel guilty about killing snails and little white lies, and you know, just it's on the a scale of things. It's all kind of harmless
in a way. It's in taking on the precepts. And this is one of the things that it does. It helps you see your tendencies. So a tendency towards guilt is a tendency towards aversion to hate. And so learning you have that potential within, that possibility, that trait, you can begin exploring what are the dynamics around guilt. Because no, guilt is kind of is a form of aversion or a form of hate. And so you get to explore that and try to work with it to in a skillful way to try to make it less of a painful thing for you. So it doesn't torment you so much. And that's considered to be a healthy move. I mean, we can put you someplace where you're not going to break any precepts at all. You know? And you'll never learn anything about yourself. And we're trying to wake up to some real deeper potential of who we are, of what reality is. And of course, at times, what it means is meeting, confronting, the places where we hold ourselves in. So then mindfulness practice is working with that in a skillful and compassionate and friendly way. That's the hard part. Yeah, it's not easy. It's easy to talk about up here, you know. It's not, you know. And so then we do loving kindness practice. Get the habit of it. Get the hang of it. And it is hard. And so, mindfulness practice. If you allow the mindfulness practice to really, if you really apply yourself in mindfulness practice, and this, and really be able to go deeply into those tendencies, you'll see something deeper behind it. And that'll help loosen that entanglement that you find yourself in when you're in the middle of it. So there's usually simplistically there's kind of two general ways to work with some of the things you're trying to deal with, and it's not easy. And one is to try to cultivate an attitude of friendliness and compassion for yourself, and to see yourself as being as worthy. Of friendship, friendliness, as all those other people outside of you are, because we're not any different. So realize that and then direct that toward yourself. The other way is to bring this very clear and consistent mindfulness to what's going on. What is happening when you're guilty? What are the feelings? How do you feel it in your body? What happens there? What is the movement there? Where does that movement of aversion arise out of? What is a judgment that is happening at that time? What is this below that? Maybe there's a sense of almost any kind of self-loathing, self-aversion, guilt arises out of a sense of hurt. And often that hurt is buried underneath a lot of guilt. And the guilt can be so strong you don't see the hurt. So if you can really learn the ability and mindfulness to be there with the guilt, without pushing it away or holding on to it or judging it any more than you are, then at some point you might see where the guilt is arising out of. And if you can see that, then there maybe is a chance of healing that. So, but it's a slow process, and it takes time. And but I think bringing it up and being willing to talk about it in a group like this, I think is actually a very healthy and healing part of the whole process, because you're being honest about it. Most of us aren't that honest, and so if you're not honest, you can't be free. Yeah.
Listening to the precepts. Last week, I had the feeling that it gave me a much better, a trustful confidence, much better confidence in what was happening in sitting.
Ah.
The stuff that would come up in my sitting sometimes were pretty bizarre, and somehow the precepts was like a little, kind of like a loosely woven net that I could fall into, but it only has five strands.
I'll give you more.
So I was thinking about your 220 book. But I found that the meditations were safer. They allowed me to go a little deeper so that the next time, well, in fact, they allowed me a little more realization too, uh-huh. as well, and so the cycle kind of gets better. That's how I...
Oh, I think that's beautiful. That's kind of what I was saying before about a container, but you said it so well. So that it's more trust. You feel it's maybe it's more trust. You can trust yourself more to open up to what's going on, because you're not you don't have to worry about, well, am I going to punch out my neighbor, or am I going to act on it or something. And you know that you can. It's okay to experience all that and all those motivations and feelings, because you know you have the precepts which are going to hold you. Is it? I think it's fantastic. Does anybody else feel that way? Anybody thought about that way or feel that way about them? No? Yes?
A year ago I was made aware of the five, and I took four of them actually. I left the one about drinking out, but one of them that I didn't expect to make a lot of difference was the killing one, and I stopped killing a lot of insects. And I felt kind of glad that I wasn't doing that, and then I felt kind of proud that I didn't think I was supposed to be killing. And then recently I was made aware of 12, and they were rather complicated, and they're very overwhelming.
These are the Thich Nhat Hanh precepts?
Pardon me?
12? I don't know the 12. Unless it's Thich Nhat Hanh.
They were just, you know. So then the suggestion was made to just take one insignificant part of one precept, and just do that, just work on that, or be aware of that. Oh, another one was never turn away from suffering, always look it in the eyes, and there's so many opportunities to do that.
Yeah.
One was not hoard your wealth, and, you know, I hoard my wealth. I mean,
yeah.
So it's tricky. And you feel, I kind of feel that.
Yeah. Thinking about pride is interesting, because pride is a feeling and an attitude which tends to certainly it creates division between people, and that's part of the danger of it. It's me against the rest. But in Buddhism, it's considered to be a virtue to delight and rejoice in your ability to follow the precepts. So you can give up the pride, but not the joy in the fact that you're doing it. So isn't that kind of nice? If you can separate the two.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And also, you know, Buddhism doesn't have this God that's watching you. So, you know, it's okay to have some guilt and some pride and all these things. I mean, we just, it's We're human beings, so we're just kind of working with what stuff we have the best we can. We don't make it worse than it is. And the thing about the precepts, there are a lot of precepts, actually. There's the 5 precepts, and the 8 precepts, and the 10 precepts, and I guess the 12 precepts, and there's 27 precepts, and there's more. You know, there's all these different precepts. And rather than taking them on as a should, as we feel what our intention is in our practice, the possibility in the practice, what we're working with, that we really, your practice should always come from you, in a sense, that you feel this is something that your spiritual practice is being motivated from some your own personal intention, and not some kind of abstract ideal or status quo or kind of peer pressure or whatever. So as you're doing that, as you're finding ways, so what you do is you find your deep intention, and then you try to bring your mindfulness practice to bear on that deep intention. And then you might go to sometimes on a retreat, or you might go to a teacher and talk to the teacher about how the teacher can help you do the thing you're trying to do for yourself. So the teacher is not imposing it, the teacher is an aid. Everything's aiding this deep intention. So in relationship to the precepts, there are all these precepts. And the thing is to see what is the connection between whatever these different precepts and your own natural desire to wake up and be present and be compassionate. And you might see for yourself, if I try out this one particular precept, that actually, rather than kind of being a should that I'm imposed and be guilty, this actually might help me become more awake. So I'll try it on for a while. And you try another one, then 1 week, and another week, another one. So it becomes an easy thing rather than trying to remember all these lists. And so your way was great. It was very nice. Yes?
I have a question about the precept about not killing.
Yeah.
Ironically, it seems whenever I hear it discussed by various people, it deals with mainly with insects.
For American Buddhists, that's the thing that seems to be most closely at hand. Yes.
Or
killing your own.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was thinking that probably.
Yeah. So what you're pointing out is something I think is very important, is that the literal meaning of the precepts are easy to understand for sure, and it's relatively easy to kind of in the most direct, obvious way for most people to follow them. Most of us aren't going out killing other people, killing animals. Other people kill animals for us, you know. most obvious things is pretty easy. But as you become more sensitive, more mindful, and also start thinking about and reflecting on it, begin seeing that these also apply to other areas that are more maybe metaphoric or more analogies. I don't know what the right word is. And that's a beautiful example, because you can kill someone else's intention, or kill someone else's joy, or kill someone else's goodwill or generosity or many things, and your own. So, so then you become sensitive to a whole different level. So the deeper level of working with the precepts is working with that. If you interrupt someone in a conversation, you've stolen something. Maybe that's one way of seeing it, and so there's that level, and that's where I kind of said earlier that the more mindful you are, the more you realize you can never really, you know, you're always breaking them, because you start seeing there's more deeper and deeper, kind of more and more subtle levels, and until finally, you know, yes.
At that level of subtlety, the interconnections between the precepts become quite evident. Well, they do on a grosser level too. I mean, if you cloud your mind in one way, you're going to cloud it in another, and you can that you break a precept and are aware of the breaking of it, I think it reflects in the other precepts as well. I'm not explaining this very well, but what my question is, since there are a great many more precepts than the five that laymen follow, does that interconnection continue on down the line, and does the net that you were speaking of become more filled in? I'm not sure that sleeping on a on a high bed or handling money is of the same degree of subtlety as the first time.
For a monk or a nun, some of the precepts are what we would in English would call maybe ethical, but a lot of them are simply training rules. So you do this because it's the training, or back in ancient India there was some association. For example, in ancient India, if you I read today, for example, this is one of them, is you're not allowed to give a Dharma talk to someone who's holding an umbrella. That's one of the rules. And the reason, the explanation, the commentary is that in ancient India, 2,500 years ago, that having an umbrella was a status symbol. And so if you're holding the umbrella, you're holding your status symbol, and you shouldn't speak to someone who is flaunting their status. So they should at least not hold it. They can put it in their lap or something. They'll put it down. And so that has more to do with customs of the times rather than you know, any. Or there's a kind of. But I think that's a separation. A lot of them are not ethical. They have to do with customs of the time, and they have to do with training precepts to help you with your training. When I was ordained as a monk, I hadn't been ordained more than maybe 5 or 6 hours, and this most senior monk came to me and said, "You have to confess for breaking the precepts." And this guy was a trip. He had kind of Calvinistic maybe mentality, maybe. And the reason I had to confess was one of the rules is your robes have to always be lined up, kind of neat. And my robes were little. These robes are you're wearing, you know, bed sheets, kind of right. And so kind of constantly kind of falling off and getting loose, and so of course they're going to kind of get a little bit crooked and kind of, and so. But it's one of the rules; you have to keep them always straight. So he wanted me to confess. But the connection between them I think they overlap. I wrote a document recently on ethics, and I said in it that the precept of not lying is particularly important, because often when you break the other precepts, you're also breaking that one. So if you just maintain that one, you're less likely to break the others. Yes.
I've got a question that sort of goes to how you could practice or should practice. And when you were speaking earlier to her about self-loathing, for example, and maybe we can use that to deepen our practice and remain follow the threads of that and unearth something. Well, a question that I have has to do with, say, anger.
Uh-huh.
And the question more specifically is, if I'm feeling angry, in terms of what we're doing here, is it a good idea to then just sit down and meditate on it and really try to get in touch with the anger and what's there? Or do I write about it? Or do I talk about it? Or all of the above?
I think you have to. Each situation has to be taken on its own terms. So, in terms of the meditation practice is to simply sit with the anger, allow it to be there, don't repress it or push it away, but don't act on it either. There's the wonderful balance between the two. So you really get to know it really well, without adding complications to it. And when it's really strong or very, very repetitive, kind of like a thing that comes up and over and over again, sometimes that's enough. You can go really deep and clarify it. Sometimes it doesn't seem to be enough for some people, and it still causes so much pain and suffering that you just don't want to continue with so much pain. Sometimes writing is a great way. Writing is kind of like, or speaking to a friend is a wonderful way of kind of doing mindfulness out loud, which is very powerful. And the way in which kind of part of mindfulness is acknowledging what we're experiencing, what's going on for us. Acknowledgement has a way of both clarifying and settling things, taking care of them. It takes some of the strength away from them, maybe. And talking out loud to a friend can be a very powerful way of acknowledging something fully. And some things seem to be really best acknowledged if you do it to someone else. That's why in Buddhism, in ancient Buddhism, there was a whole tradition of what's been translated into English as confession. And I think part of the value of that was not because you have to go and confess your sins, because there's no sins in Buddhism, but some things are best taken care of by verbally acknowledging with someone else. I think a lot of the benefit of therapy is aside from whatever skills a therapist has, you know, in terms of working with you, is simply the therapy is a place where you can actually vocalize and acknowledge out loud what's going on. So all the above, I think, depending on the situation. And then also to be discerning about the anger, because the Buddhist tendency, because we're focusing so much on practice, and practice is a big part of practice, so internal. The tendency for Buddhists is always to see, well, what is my role in this? How did I respond and act in this situation? And how can I? So it's like I've had encounters with other Buddhists where we kind of had kind of a little difficulty. And then I go home and I thought about it for a while and I said, gee, you know, I really made a mistake there, didn't I? And then I call up and say, you know, I want to apologize for, you know, for what I did. Oh, I was going to call you and apologize for what I... You know, I feel so responsible, you know. And because Buddhists, it's a trait, it's a beautiful trait, I think, of Buddhists, is to always go see what was my responsibility in this thing. But you can go too far. And that's the danger in Buddhism also. It's a beauty, but also a danger among some Buddhists, is there's a hesitation among true blue Buddhists. I don't know. To see clearly what's happening outside of your responsibility sometimes. Sometimes it's too much internal. And sometimes you need to act in a situation and say something to someone else and say no, or say, let's talk about it, or let's have a mediator, or something has to happen besides just your own stuff. Is that enough, you think? Within the next 2 months, I plan on giving a talk, I think probably Monday night, on anger. It seems like it's time. It's, you know, it's been long enough now, and it's it's one of the most popular topics. And someone will always disagree with me. I've been trying for years to give a talk on anger that Brigitte doesn't take exception to. And I hope she never, I hope I never succeed. So, yes?
I was just going to say, it must be all the hot weather you
can. Could be, yes. Oh, this is interesting. Oh, excuse me, if I may say, I was going to, this is a random thought, footnote to that. I live up on Skyline, the 2,000 feet, so I kind of live above the smog, I think. So I was driving down today, and I was looking down in the fog across. It's very foggy today. It's one of the thick, maybe one. And it's kind of trapped in the bay. And I was thinking about it, and I said, and I was thinking about the precepts, and especially the second precept about not stealing. And I thought there was a connection. And I said, we're generating all the smog, and staying here where we're generating it. And for once in a rare time, we're not sending it to Fresno. And if you ever go down to the Central Valley and up against the foothills there, Sierras, all the Bay Area fog goes down there and it lingers down there. And, you know, out of mind, out of, you know, like you say, out of sight, out of mind, right? So we're generating all the time. And so, I don't know, is it breaking a precept to create all the smog and send it to Fresno? So, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I have both a comment and a question about things that have been touched on by all the other things. When you talk about how the precepts and the meditation and mindfulness are related, it came to my mind that there's... I'm just new to this, and I don't really know the precepts, except for that they're pretty common in all religions.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's very easy to see what the right thing is to do, and other times it's not so easy.
Yeah.
And I have found at times that in meditating and going inner, not so much with mindfulness but other techniques, that it becomes clearer to me what is the right thing.
Yeah.
That's my comment. Now my question is, I'm in a particular situation in my life now that things aren't very clear to me at all as to what is the right thing. And a particular piece is that what seems right to another person, I have compassion and I can see their viewpoint, and I actually have more of a tendency to, oh yes, of course.
Yeah.
And then sometimes forget that, oh wait, you know, this is my viewpoint, which is equally valid, and have compassion for that. So my question is are there any thoughts, techniques, whatever that you might have that this mindfulness might help? I mean, I find talking to people sometimes gets it clearer, but yeah. Nobody knows. The best thing is when I can touch into something inside of myself that knows.
Yes, yes. So I think that's beautifully said, and that's one very dramatic connection between precepts and mindfulness is, if you become, if you can become aware enough of your own deeper integrity, which often surfaces when you're quiet enough, it's a lot clearer what not only what you should do, but what you want to do, and what you don't want to do. And when you're not in touch with that integrity and you're in your surface mind, you think that's what you want to do. You know, you think, well, it's my freedom. I want to express myself. And you think, you know, you think that person, you know, self-expression, you know, is the right thing to do. And you, but it's just that surface mind, which is running around like a monkey, and you end up in trouble. It's not what you really want to do. So simply practicing, having some kind of practice that helps you. There's many ways. In Buddhism, one of the guidelines to help us with these kind of things is to pay a lot of attention to our intention. And the criteria, ultimate criteria in Buddhism, is the intention behind the act. So is the intention wholesome? If there's unwholesome aspect to the intention, then maybe you shouldn't act on it. Or then you should spend more time clarifying it. But if your intention is wholesome, then you're in a safer area. And sometimes you have to be very quiet or pay very careful attention to discover what your intention is. But that has a lot to do with it. And that'll help in a lot of situations because sometimes our intention is tinged by aversion or hate or greed or fear. And when you see that, you say, oh, wait a minute, maybe I better take it a little bit slow here and look more carefully. Or you might find after a while, oh, it's not. So maybe it's now I can state it or say it or explore it some more. Part of the value of meditation practice is that it gives us a taste, maybe not immediately, but it starts giving us a taste of a feeling, or at least a hint of what it's like to be in a mind and a body without fear, without hate, without aversion, without greed, without confusion. And if you can get that taste, that feeling of what that is, you can recognize much more clearly when your experience, your mind-body experience, is tinged by those things. And if you have more of a reference, and if you can see that, then maybe you can, you can notice when you're acting out of fear. You notice when you're acting out of aversion much more earlier. And you appreciate what it feels like to be in a place that's not acting out of not acting out of fear or aversion or confusion. So one of the connections between mindfulness practice and the precepts is that the precepts are a definition, kind of how you would act if you're acting from a place without any fear or aversion. And so if you find yourself breaking a precept, it isn't that you're breaking some moral code that's bad to break. It's showing you that you've lost touch with some part of yourself which maybe, hopefully, you value very much yourself. And so the meditation practice is about learning some part of yourself that you really value. And as you learn, as you value it more and more, the precepts become a wonderful guideline for how to stay in touch with what you love. So it's kind of a, so that's why the joy, the love of the joy of the precepts is because you found something you love and enjoy within yourself. And then at some point, it isn't just personal, because at some point in the mindfulness practice, meditation practice, some of the harder boundaries we have between self and other break down. And you feel that your own, what's of most value inside of you, resonates with what's most value in someone else. So you also want to honor that valuable essence or whatever of others. So you're not only living a precept because it's good for your own essence, you're living a precept because of that resonance between your own and that of other people. And that's a hopefully, if you follow what I've said, you can also maybe have a sense that it actually can be joyful thing to do. And why Buddhists like to talk about precepts. So anyway, it's enough. We should sit, I think. We'll sit for 15 minutes.